This is the first of three two-hour lectures that I'm giving today, tomorrow, and Wednesday on dissent. And I'm going to have a very specific view of the subject, so I have to introduce that right now. And my basic idea will be to try to find links between the problem of dissent and Lie theory, by which I mean the idea of studying the exponential map. So the interaction between ordinary differential equations and algebra. But I hope that, if not by the end of today's lecture, then at least at the beginning of tomorrow's lecture, it'll be clearer what on earth I'm talking about. So I think the best place to begin is just to discuss some examples of the general problem of dissent, in the sense that I'm interested in it. I should warn you that I'm very much approaching this as a differential geometer. I'm not a very sophisticated homotopy theorist at all, and my motivation is, in some sense, eventually, to try to use ideas of dissent to put the theory of, say, three groupoids into a state where it can be used by mathematical physicists more easily. So let me start by the simplest example. I want to take define dissent for a presheaf of groups. Okay. In general, by dissent, I mean the general problem of finding derived sections of a presheaf. And if we have a presheaf of groups on a space X, so this will be just an assignment to open subsets of the space of a group. And now, to do dissent, I need to have some additional data, and in this case, I'll take as my data a cover of my space. So let the sets UI, where I runs over some set of indices, be an open cover of X. And I'm going to define the global sections of this presheaf, but in a derived sense. Now, in the usual sense, it'll be some group. It'll just be G of X. But in the derived sense, it isn't actually a group, it's a groupoid. So I need to define this groupoid, and with the data of a cover, I can do that. So how do I do that? So let me denote denote this derived sections by this notation. So this is the dissent groupoid, not group, of the presheaf G for the cover U. And of course, as I change the cover, I'll get different groupoids, but if the cover is taken fine enough, I should get equivalent groupoids. So what is this groupoid? Well, its objects are defined in the following way. So the objects, they're just one cocycle for this presheaf. With respect to this cover. So let's recall what that is, i.e. it's a collection of data, gi0, i1, which is a section of g on ui0, i1, as i0 and i1. Run over the indexing set I. Whoops. And here, let's recall, I'm using a very standard notation in which these open sets indexed by i0 up to ik are just the intersections of the sets in the cover. Okay. So what does it mean to be a cocycle? This is a cochain. So and then the condition is that G I0 I1 G I1 I2 equals G I0 I2 for all I0 I1 I2 in the indexing set. Now, this is when, of course, this doesn't quite make sense. As it's written, I have to tell you where the product is occurring. And it's actually occurring in G of U I0 I1 I2. So what I should have written here in this cocycle condition is that each of the elements of the group over different open sets are now restricted to this common intersection. You may also want to normalize the cochain, but let me leave that sort of thing out. Let me just forge on. So that's the objects, and the morphisms are going to be defined in a vaguely similar way. So I am going to have a morphism from a cocycle G to a cocycle H, and this is going to, in fact, be a zero cocycle such that it essentially, so here, and so phi acts as an intertwiner for the two one cocycles. Something like that. I don't actually completely vouch for these formulas because this isn't the way I usually think about constructing this descent groupoid. Later, I'll give you a firm definition, which is the one that I'm going to stick to. So I think I've explained my first small point, which is that descent of groups gives a groupoid. And you can actually extend this definition by replacing the original sheaf of groups by a sheaf of groupoids. Then maybe it's more natural to see that descent of a pre-sheaf of groupoids with respect to this cover is going to give a groupoid. And the definition is only lightly modified. Now, in defining an object, I need to give you, in addition, for each open set, for each open set in the cover, I have to give you an object of the groupoid over that open set. And then these morphisms have to go between the restrictions of those objects to these open sets. The cocycle condition is now an identity in the groupoid here, and you have to modify the definition of morphisms correspondingly. So this definition is easily extended to pre-sheaves of groupoids. You have to augment the data of an object by taking an object of GUI for each. Let me call the object xi. So I need an object over each open set. Instead of writing out in greater detail what I'm talking about, let me jump to the next case that I know about, which is if I have a pre-sheaf of two groupoids. And now there's a construction which actually kind of came up in passing in the conference a couple of weeks ago in Wendy Lowen's talk, where in non-commutative deformations of a scheme, it turns out that there's a two groupoid lying in the background, and one way of looking at the problem of formal quantization of a scheme is to look at the descent two groupoid. Descent two groupoid. We'll see more two groupoids later. But now the basic idea is, so the objects, I'll just tell you what an object is, and only, in fact, roughly. You can look up in various papers, although I'm hesitant to give out references because I don't know the original reference for this. But there's certainly a very interesting paper by Konsevich on deformation quantization of schemes. Anyway, the objects are as follows. To each UI, we take an object of GUI for each I. So let me call that an object XI. So again, over each open set of the cover, we have an object of the two groupoid. Now, I also need for each intersection of two open sets in the cover, I'm going to take one morphism of the groupoid. And finally, I'm going to take a two morphism for each intersection of three open sets. So there's some sort of pattern going on here. And in fact, you can systematize this nicely in terms of nerves of two groupoids, which I'll talk about tomorrow. And so now we have some conditions which, in the world of, let me say then that they involve source and target maps and compositions. And basically, what do they say? They say that G, I0, I1, that its source is the restriction of XI. To XI1 to I0, I1, and its target is the restriction of XI0 to UI0, I1. And then we have a condition involving, we had a one cocycle condition when we were doing descent of one groupoids, but of course, that's much too much to demand. What we instead are going to have is that phi will define an isomorphism between the two sides of the one cocycle condition. So if we take G I0 I1, let's say I2, restricted to I0, UI0 I1 I2, then phi I0, I1, I2 is a two morphism from this morphism to the composed morphism. Obtained from G I0 I1 and G I1 I2. It's a two morphism. So two morphisms. This is a sheaf of two groupoids. Oops. Yeah. Sorry. I forgot to say that. Yeah. G is now a pre-sheaf of two groupoids. So I haven't quite finished defining the objects because finally there's a three co-cycle condition involving the five. Which I don't want to write down right now. And instead, I want to give a few examples of what all this descent is about in a couple of cases you'll have heard of, just to show that this is a construction. All of this is really abstracting things which we basically spent a lot of our early graduate study trying to understand. So, examples. So if G is a constant pre-sheaf of groups, then what I've constructed in my descent of this pre-sheaf of groups is nothing other than the principal bundles associated to this group. They're going to be the objects, because of course, so principal bundles such which are trivialized by the cover, together with morphisms of these trivial bundles, which can be defined with respect to this cover. So if the cover is sufficiently fine, if you're in the world of differential geometry, then you can actually find a single cover, which is sufficiently fine. In algebraic geometry, you might have to take a sequence of refinements. So the objects are G principal bundles defined over cover U, and the morphisms are just morphisms of G bundles. So so as I said, my vague motivation for all of this is that it appears in physics that we should be studying higher principal bundles, whose structure groups are not just groups, but two groups and three groups. And it's true that homotopy theory has already answered all the questions, really, that there are to answer about descent in that context. But my goal is to get a more geometric picture of what's going on. I want to actually be able to find some coordinates and study all of these maps in local coordinates. So let me change gears a little and talk instead about, so I got a bit bored just doing groupoids and two groupoids, let me move to N groupoids. So the simplest example of an N groupoid that I know is if I have an abelian group A, and N is a natural number, then KAN will be my prototypical example of an N groupoid. I think everyone, so I'm leaving out all those words like weak or very weak, this is an extremely weak notion of an n-groupoid. But as everyone knows, n-groupoids are there to model homotopy types where the homotopy groups vanish above pi n. And certainly this is a basic example of a topological space whose homotopy groups vanish above n. So if whatever notion of n-groupoid you're going to cook up, it had better be adapted to cover this case. And tomorrow I'll discuss exactly a notion of n-groupoid which precisely captures objects like this. So more generally, I could have a presheaf of abelian groups, and then I can ask, okay, if I got a two-groupoid by descent of a presheaf of two groupoids, what's the n-groupoid that I get from descent of this presheaf of n-groupoids? So more generally, consider a presheaf A. What is the descent n-groupoid of K A N A presheaf of N groupoids? And this, one of the tests for this is going to be that if N is 1, so I know what KA1 is, it's just the classifying space of A, then this had all better agree with what I had before. So, well, one thing I can tell you about this N groupoid is its homotopy groups. And the homotopy groups are just, as you could guess, they're the only groups in town are the sheaf cohomology groups of the presheaf A. So actually, well, the check, I should say, cohomology groups, and so we get this identification. So what we have is, indeed, the homotopy groups are only non-trivial from 0 to n, and they are essentially the bottom n plus 1 check cohomology groups of A, of the presheaf A, turned upside down. There's a simple reason why we have to turn them upside down, which is that here what we're looking at is homotopy groups which are associated to chain complexes, whereas cohomology is giving us a cochain complex, and so we have to kind of turn our cochain complex upside down to make it into a chain complex, and then throw away all the negative degree pieces, because there's no negative homotopy groups in an n-groupoid. So it's simply a truncation process. And in fact, if I identify some sort of abelian n-groupoids simply as chain complexes of abelian groups in degrees 0 to n, then the descent groupoid is simply the truncated check complex. So I wrote down what it was. So we take the check complex of with respect to the cover U of this graded abelian group. This is now some cochain complex, and hence a chain complex if we reverse all the directions of the arrows, and then I have to truncate this into negative cohomological degree, which is positive homological degree. So this is the identification, and then the story is, at least if you normalize this correctly, this really is an n-groupoid. Whatever I mean by an n-groupoid. So I'm going to have to, at least it's a Kahn complex. That much we know.
Are you on the check homology in all this game?
Well, no, I'm going to actually use a co-simplicial language. So if I have any way of doing, so for example, if there are sufficient points, I can use a Godamon resolution. It'll be some co-simplicial gadget. It's just somewhat bigger and less familiar, I think, to differential geometers.
On the outside
yes.
Of differential
geometry, absolutely not. So, but when I said space, I really was thinking, you know, like manifold or something. I'm trying to ignore all those problems which are which I'm no expert on, about hypercovers and whatnot. But my basic technology is just going to be, I'm going to very rapidly move to the co-simplicial technology, and that'll, the idea is that whatever theorem you can prove about how to calculate cohomology, the descent will occur via doing something to a co-simplicial object. So now comes the punchline of this, which is I want to think of a graded abelian group. So this is an abelian, this is a complex of abelian groups concentrated in degree negative n, cohomological degree negative n, and I want to think of this as a differential graded Lie algebra. Well, a very simple differential graded Lie algebra, its bracket is zero, but it's still a differential graded Lie algebra, and I want to generalize all of this construction to differential graded Lie algebras. And then in my third lecture, I'll try to show how that links up with the problem of doing descent for higher groupoids. The idea is that differential graded Lie algebras should be the sort of tangent space of a higher groupoid, and I want to get some sort of correspondence going. So there are going to be lots of gaps in these lectures. I can't do this in utter generality because I'll need to assume that my differential graded Lie algebras are nilpotent. That's going to be the main standing assumption. And this is a kind of basic assumption that we meet over and over again in homotopy theory and deformation theory, and is, well, it basically means that you can push any analytic questions outside the discussion. But it does mean that my discussion is going to be somewhat limited yet in applications to physics, unfortunately. So, let me talk a bit about some nice examples of sheaves, pre-sheaves of differential graded Lie algebras, and why they're interesting. So I'm not entirely sure of my audience, but I thought it's often a good idea to actually define what a differential graded Lie algebra is. Is that somebody, at least one or two people are nodding. So what is a differential graded Lie algebra? So as I said, I'm going to tend to work with co-chain complexes in these lectures. So I'm going to have a sequence of vector spaces. I'm always going to work over a field of characteristic zero. I'm doing Lie theory, and so since I want to solve ODEs, I really do need this hypothesis. And then my complex has, in addition, a collection of brackets which go from the space of vectors of elements of the graded Lie algebra of degree I tensored those of degree j to degree I plus j. And so we modify the usual definitions of a Lie algebra to somehow cope with the grading, and while in some sense routine, it leads to some surprising little points which it's worth emphasizing. So first of all, if x is in Li and y is in Lj, then the bracket is skew symmetric, but only in a graded sense. So we, as usual, in when you're dealing with graded vector spaces and when you have to kind of pass one element over another, you pick up a sign. And this sign, if you notice, the sign is only non-trivial if both I and J have odd parity. So if I and J both have, if one of them has even parity, this is just a negative sign as usual. But if they both have odd parity, it's a plus sign. And that leads to the following observation. So in particular, if I is odd, then x bracket x equals x bracket x. That's all we can conclude. So in general, in a differential graded Lie algebra, the bracket of something of odd degree with itself is not constrained, except that it's an element of L2i. There's no law like there is in a Lie algebra that the bracket of something with itself is zero. On the other hand, now I'm going to write down the Jacobi relation. That will imply that the bracket of this with x is zero. So we have x bracket y bracket z equals x bracket y bracket z plus minus 1 to the ij y bracket x bracket z. So here z is an arbitrary element of the differential graded Lie algebra, and what I'm doing is so there are different ways to think about this relation. I think in all, maybe there are three different ways to understand what the Jacobi relation says. This one says that bracketing with x is a graded derivation of the Lie bracket. So there are two terms on the right-hand side, in one of which x attacks y, and in the other of which x attacks z. So add x is a graded derivation. Graded derivation is what this sign means. There's another way to think of this, which is that add x composed with add y minus 1 to the ij add y composed with add x is add x bracket y. So from this point of view, the operation which takes elements of the graded Lie algebra and thinks of them as endomorphisms of the graded Lie algebra, this is a homomorphism of differential graded Lie algebras, where we give the endomorphisms the graded commutator as its graded Lie bracket. And this is something worth mentioning, that if you have a graded vector space, then endomorphisms themselves form a graded Lie algebra with respect to the generalization of this bracket. And then, that's the second point of view on what this says. There's a third point of view, which is similar to the very neat way of writing the Jacobi relation as a sum over three cycles in XYZ, but I find the signs become somewhat confusing. So I don't even use that that formulation in the graded case. So this is the Jacobi relation, and an exercise is to check if x is in L1, then x bracket x is zero. And certainly this is true in a graded in the graded commutator example. Because in that case, x bracket x is just x squared plus x squared, so it's just 2x squared. And then x certainly commutes with 2x squared. And so that's what this relation says in that case. And there's one more axiom for a differential graded Lie algebra. D of x bracket y is dx y bracket y plus minus 1 to the I x bracket dy. So what are some examples of differential graded Lie algebras? Well, so far we only have two general classes. The first is Lie algebras are differential graded Lie algebras. I put everything in degree 0, the differential is certainly 0 then, and the only bracket which is non-zero is the one which takes the bracket of two elements of the algebra to itself. So Lie algebras are in particular differential graded Lie algebras, and also complexes of vector spaces are differential graded Lie algebras, which I call abelian differential graded Lie algebras. So you'll want some examples, and so the examples I like come from differential geometry, and I don't know how well they'll go down here. So let me start by giving. If I have a complex manifold, then I can certainly look at the sheaf of holomorphic vector fields. So this sheaf, unless the manifold is a Stein manifold, this sheaf has higher cohomology groups, just thinking of it as a sheaf of vector spaces. So it's not yet terribly well behaved, and the question arises, can I do descent for it? And if I imitate what I did in the cochain case with a sheaf of abelian groups, I'm going to get some complex of vector spaces which will somehow turns out not be a differential graded Lie algebra. It'll be something else, and that's the theme of today's lecture. It'll be a generalization, which is usually called an L-infinity algebra. So I want to give an explicit formula today for this L-infinity structure. The pre-sheaf is holomorphic vector fields. And if I do descent, I get cochains of holomorphic vector fields, and you can truncate it then, and you expect, in some sense, to have something which is a model, an infinitesimal model for some groupoid. The problem is that it's not a differential graded Lie algebra. It's actually an L-infinity algebra. There are somehow weaker or softer ways to take resolution which do give you a differential graded Lie algebra. And the softest one of all is the Dolbeau resolution. So that I just want to mention now as a good example of a differential graded Lie algebra. So I think, as we know, whenever we have a sheaf of, and whenever we have a holomorphic vector bundle, there's this canonical resolution of it, the Dolbeau resolution. And so Li will be the ith degree anti-holomorphic differential forms on M with values in the tangent bundle. And then, of course, by the Dolbeau lemma, locally, this gives you a resolution of the sheaf of holomorphic vector fields. So this actually is a differential graded Lie algebra. Somehow, the bracket is Lie bracket coupled with exterior multiplication of differential forms. And the differential is D bar. The Durham complex is used somehow to resolve locally constant sheaves. This sheaf is not locally constant, and so I want to do this, if you like. It turns out, Durham complexes come up in special contexts, if the manifold is what's called a Calabi-Yau. I'm thinking on my feet here, so I may be saying something wrong. Let me not give too many more examples of this yet. Later in my lectures, I'll give a lot more examples of differential graded Lie algebras. But in the 1980s, a point of view developed, which was that if you do Lie theory for this differential graded Lie algebra, you'll get a groupoid. And this groupoid is somehow the groupoid that Kadira and Spencer introduced, which is the deformation groupoid of the complex manifold. So from this point of view, deformation theory, at least in characteristic zero, is a branch of Lie theory, but a generalization of the original Lie theory, which is just the case of a Lie algebra. Exponentiating this differential Lie algebra gives a groupoid the stack of complex deformations of M. Since that's a very obscure point, if you haven't seen this before, let me very briefly indicate how the construction goes, always with this caveat that in real life we're going to have to assume that the differential graded Lie algebra is nilpotent. And this differential graded Lie algebra isn't nilpotent, so you actually have to do the whole construction with some ring of coefficients of truncated polynomials, and you get nth order jets of the deformation stack. So it really only models formal deformation theory, as I've stated it, to actually get a model of an actual chunk, a finite chunk of the deformation space. You have to, at some point, bring in Banach spaces, and I don't know how to do that in this very abstract setting. So, so how does it go? Well, the basic idea is that the objects of this groupoid will be deformations of the differential. This is always the idea which will be underlying the construction. It doesn't sound like Lie theory, but what I'll show you, I don't know if I'll get to it today, perhaps I will, I'll show you that in some sense ordinary Lie theory, where you construct elements of points in a Lie group, can be thought of in fact as a generalization of the idea of deforming the differential. So I should say this groupoid is commonly referred to as the Deligne groupoid. And they're deformations of the differential on L of the form. Let me do the abstract case. D sub omega equals d plus add omega, where omega is in L1. And what I should be thinking of in general is something like d is some flat connection and omega is some connection one form that I'm adding to d. This is if you're into the point of view of thinking about gauge theory, connections on vector bundles. And now my condition is this should be a differential. Well, d omega squared, if you use the graded Jacobi, is equal to add of 1/2 omega bracket omega. Oops, I'm sorry. No, it isn't. D omega plus 1/2 omega bracket omega. And you should recognize this as some sort of formula for curvature of omega. So, motivated by this, we take the set of elements of L1 such that this vanishes as the objects of our groupoid. So, since this equation is called the Mora-Cartan equation, I'll call this set the Mora-Cartan set. So it's the set of all elements of L1 such that d omega plus 1/2 omega omega equals 0. If we go back to this example here, then we get exactly Kodaira and Spencer's equation for deformations of the complex structure of the manifold. So this set is the set of nearby, or actually infinitely nearby, deformations of the complex structure. And then there's going to be a group that acts on this, which is the group, or the Lie group, if you like, associated with the Lie algebra underlying this differential graded Lie algebra. So here we have L0 is just vector fields on the manifold. Real vector, well, complex valued, but with no condition of holomorphicity. And what's the Lie group associated with that? Well, it's some sort of complex version of the diffeomorphism group. So, I mean, the basic idea is that I just have the diffeomorphism group acting on here. So the groupoid is MCL quotiented by the group associated to L0, and in our case this is nearby complex structures, and this is diff 0 of M. I guess I mean diffeomorphisms which are quite close to the identity, whatever that means. So that's the picture, and the basic point of my talk, of my lectures, is to generalize this to much more general differential graded Lie algebras, and then to look at descent on both sides, descent for a presheaf of differential graded Lie algebras, and descent for a presheaf of n-groupoids, and compare the results. I want to show that I get equivalent n group weights, and I want to find some canonical equivalence between them. So I should maybe say that special cases of this have been done by Hinnisch and Schechtmann. So what I'm basically trying to do here is generalize from group weights to higher group weights the results of Hinnisch. Okay. So I'm not sure how to use my 2 hours, in principle I should have a little gap at some point. I don't want to just go on. I could just go on for an hour and a half and stop. That would be an alternative. Or I can have a short break of 5 minutes and then start all over. Should I have a short break now? So let me have exactly 5 minute break, which means, according to my watch, it's 10 to 2, and I'll start again at 5 to 2. Yes. Yes.
Is there an actual definition of this sort of group points? Do you need an example?
Ah. We'll start again in a few seconds. Okay. So now I'll turn to producing a, well, I'm going to be doing two things at once, but the techniques are the same. So what I'm going to be doing is showing how to construct a n-groupoid from a differential graded Lie algebra, and I'm going to be showing how to descend cosimplicial Lie algebras. So the basic technique that I'm going to use is, well, I'm going to use a bunch of techniques. The first one is I have to extend to L infinity algebras. Turns out, on the one hand, that I can't do descent unless I work with L infinity algebras, and on the other hand, the construction of n-groupoids works just as nicely for L infinity algebras as for differential graded Lie algebras, so there's no great reason to prefer one over the other. So let me start by supposing that I have a finite dimensional differential graded Lie algebra. So let L be a finite dimensional differential graded Lie algebra. So then we have a we can form the Chevalier-Eilenberg algebra of cochains on L. Let me denote this by C upper star L. So I'm, although I carefully defined what a differential graded Lie algebra is, maybe I'll skip defining carefully what a differential graded commutative algebra is. It's the same sort of style, except now you have, so associativity is just the usual associativity for a graded algebra. Graded commutativity is done along the lines of differential graded Lie algebras, except they're much more familiar to us because differential forms are an example. But here's a different example, the cochains on a finite dimensional Lie algebra, and this is the exterior algebra of the dual of L. And let me be somewhat careful here. The dual of L in degree I is L in degree minus I dualized. This is kind of clear in that there should be a pairing between L and its dual. And a pairing should add degrees. And so you need to be pairing something in degree I with something in degree minus I. So what do I mean by the exterior algebra of a complex, since usually we only define the exterior algebra for a vector space? I mean the symmetric tensors on L. This time I first shift L down in degree by one before dualizing. Oh, did I get that right? Okay, so I always have to do a little side calculation. I meant to do this here. So we're going to know whether we did it. I think, yeah, I did it right, because if L started out life as a Lie algebra, then this shoots it down to degree negative 1. Then we dualize it, so we have the dual of the original Lie algebra in degree 1. And now the symmetric tensors on that are just the exterior algebra of that vector space in the usual sense. And the point is that because our original guy was a differential graded Lie algebra, this has a canonical differential on it. By differential, I mean it has square zero, and it's a graded derivation of degree 1 of this algebra. So the basic, as you know, to define a derivation on a free graded commutative algebra like this one, it suffices to say what the values of this differential are, of this derivation are, on the generators. So I just need to tell you how, let me, so I'll have delta n for n greater than or equal to 1. Well, actually, for n equal to 1 and 2. So for n equals 1, it's just a map from the dual of L to the dual of L. It has to have degree 1. It's just the adjoint of the differential. And for n equals 2, it's constructed from the Lie bracket. It's the adjoint of the Lie bracket. It's a bit surprising that suspension takes you from a graded, a skew symmetric, graded skew symmetric operation to a graded symmetric one, but that's just, in fact, true. So suspension flips us backward and forward between antisymmetry and symmetry. Okay, and now comes the punchline that all the rules that I gave you that have to be satisfied by the differential and the bracket on my graded differential graded Lie algebra are captured by delta squared to zero. So delta squared has components for n equals 1, 2, and 3. So for n equals 1, the vanishing that's just d squared is 0. Yes. Yes, thank you. So delta squared, it's n equals 1 component vanishing is just d squared equals 0. Whoops, 1. 2, the second component vanishing, that's just Leibniz. So that's dxy equals. And the third component is the Jacobi relation. So you see that maybe it's an excessively elegant formulation of what a differential graded Lie algebra is, at least if it's finite dimensional, is just to say that it's a free differential graded commutative algebra with a graded derivation with homogeneous components for n equals 1 and 2, which satisfies delta squared to 0. This point of view, of course, has been dramatically generalized in the theory of Kossel operads, but let's just stick to it for Lie algebras here.
Right. Yeah.
Delta squared. Delta, half the bracket of delta with delta. But it's delta is an endomorphism of this graded vector space, so I just do it twice. But as you say, the graded derivations form a graded Lie algebra, and delta squared is half delta bracket delta. That's actually worth mentioning. So, theorem. So what's very interesting is I've delved back in the literature, and I've found in the supergravity literature in 1981 and 1982 that, and in fact they have all the correct references. They dutifully refer to Sullivan's work on rational homotopy theory, and they find finitely generated free differential graded commutative algebras. I'm sorry, I've misstated the theorem here, such that the differential delta is the sum of delta 1 plus delta 2. So they dutifully record this, and then they say, but we need more general deltas. We're going to need deltas with components of homogeneous of degree 1, 2, 3, and 4. And this is the earliest use of what I think are now called L infinity algebras that I've been able to find. So not much has happened since 1982 in the subject, unfortunately, but one can always hope. So generalization allow delta 3, delta 4, and so on. In other words, let's define a finite dimensional L infinity algebra just to be a finitely generated free differential graded commutative algebra with some set generators. Then the duals of those generators are going to be the actual L infinity algebra. Well, this is a bit restrictive because I've assumed that I had a finite dimensional differential graded Lie algebra, but in fact that's somehow immaterial. That's because I insisted on working here with the cochains. I could have worked with the chains, which are a commutative co-algebra. I don't much like working with commutative co-algebras because the notation is less intuitive, and so I preferred to give this more restrictive version of the theorem. But the correct version of the theorem is actually much more general and works without hypotheses of finite dimensionality. Now, in any case, I can unwind what all this says and tell you in a much more down-to-earth way what exactly an L-infinity algebra is. It's going to be so it's a complex L, as before. And now it has brackets for n greater than 1, but not just n equal to 2. And these go from Li1 tensor up to Lin to L. I1 plus up to In plus 1 minus n. Whoops. That doesn't look right, does it? 2 minus n. Right. So for n equals 2, we just have our earlier bracket, which goes from Li1 tensor Li2 to Li1 plus I2. And now there's a new bracket, a triple bracket, which from the point of view of Lie theory seems less important, but what I will be showing you is that from the point of view, say, of two groupoids, it's quite important because it's going to correspond to somehow the logarithm of the associator in some two groupoid. So, and so on. There are higher ones, and it becomes harder and harder to attach names to the meaning of these higher brackets because we don't have enough words to talk about higher groupoids due to their enormous complexity. So there are a lot of axioms now, but they have roughly similar style to the axioms I gave for differential graded Lie algebras. And as I said, the first place that I've been able to find where something equivalent to this is stated is this Italian, so supergravity let's say, the Milan School, 1981-2. But of course, in the mathematics literature, they were formalized in the early 90s or late 80s by Hinisch and Scheckmann and Lada and Stashev. So the axioms are as follows. So we have graded anti-symmetry. And here what happens is if I switch two arguments of my bracket, then I get a sign. And the sign is the same one that I had in the case of Lie algebras. Of course, it suffices. The whole action of the symmetric group is generated by swapping consecutive pairs, so it suffices to state the axiom in this way. Okay, here of course I'm assuming that xj is in Lij for j going from 1 to n. And now, let me extend this definition for the purposes of the writing the next relation by making the unary bracket the differential. The differential does indeed go from Li to Li plus 1, so it fits into this pattern. It's just not maybe so customary to think of a unary operation as an operation, but it is. And if we make that definition, then the form at least of the generalized Jacobi relation is very, very uniform. So it's a bit complicated though. I'm going to formulate it as a sum over elements of the symmetric group, and then I'll sum from 1 to n, and I'll have a factor of L factorial n minus L factorial, and I have a whole question of what sign to put here, which actually the way I'm doing it, I think the sign depends on L. So I'll come back to the sign in a moment. And then the basic form of each term is an iterated bracket. So this is the L bracket, and then there's an outer bracket, which is an n minus L plus 1 bracket, and the sum of all those terms have to equal 0. So I'm being very lazy here. I'm assuming I'm in characteristic 0. I could clear, you can divide this through by some common factor and get a definition. Well, actually, there's no point. Somehow L infinity algebras, are only really interesting in characteristic 0. I should say. So what's going on here? What's the sign? Actually, to work out the sign, the only way I know how to do it is to rewrite all of this in terms of the desuspension of L. So replace L by L shifted down in degree by 1, and then the brackets are replaced by, let me call this V. They're now graded symmetric brackets, and they all have degree one after I've performed this shift, and that simplifies the signs already. And the relationship is a bit confusing, so the relationship to get from a graded antisymmetric operation to a graded symmetric one on the suspension, you have to throw in this sign. If you do that, then you get the correct correspondence. And now the signs are easy to work out. You just use the natural sign rule for the graded vector space V. So that's the most satisfactory way I know to work out what the signs are in that equation. So I think from what I've already said, you see that for n equals 1, this equation, so use natural signs for action of pi on x1 tensor to xn in the nth, in V tensor M. So in this equation, for n equals 1, we just get d squared equals 0. For n equals 2, again, we get this Leibniz for the second bracket. And for n equals 3, basically what we see is that the triple bracket is a homotopy for the Jacobi relation. I'll just write it in this symbolic fashion. Basically, you take the thing which would vanish by Jacobi for a graded Lie algebra, and it's homotopic to zero by this totally antisymmetric homotopy. Then, of course, this triple bracket itself has to satisfy higher Jacobi relations. The whole thing is bound together in a very tight package, and essentially we have coherences all the way up. And there are different ways to understand why we want to impose this collection of coherences. One way, which I like best, probably, is simply this theorem somehow is motivating it. From the point of view of Kossel operads, for those of you who know a bit about operads, the basic idea is that here we have a differential graded operad, which, if we forget the differential, is a free operad generated by these operations. And this operad is a resolution of the Lie operad. So you can think of it as it is a cofibrant resolution of the Lie operad, and as such, its algebras are the category of differential graded algebras for a cofibrant operad, and thus have many nice properties. So that's a slightly more sophisticated perspective. But I don't need a lot of what I say then does in fact extend to more general cofibrant operads, but I'm just going to do it for L infinity. So we have the following basic problem. So in the next thing I was going to do was say, let A be a cosimplicial cochain complex. And then it occurs to me maybe I should say a few words about what a cosimplicial thing is. So has anybody in previous lectures in this workshop talked about cosimplicial things? Inevitably, yes. Well, indeed. They are somehow inevitable. What I'm going to say is insufficient if you haven't met them before. But basically, let's just bite the bullet. So I'm going to recall this category delta. This is a countable category whose objects are the natural numbers, thought of as posets. So the objects are these posets. And then the morphisms are just the morphisms of these posets. So they're monotonic maps, sort of weakly monotonic maps between these posets. Well, they're totally ordered posets. So you can think of it as a rather small corner of the category of categories. So a cosimplicial object in a category is just a functor from delta to the category. And you can think of these in some vague way as a generalization of cochain complexes. In fact, we pushed this by writing xn I should have given this a name. This object is usually denoted n with square brackets, and if we evaluate our cosimplicial object on this object n, we write it in a way which is definitely reminiscent of cochain complexes. Well, like any category, like any what I want to say, these cosimplicial objects themselves form a category where the morphisms between cosimplicial objects are natural transformations of the functors. So we have a category of cosimplicial objects. So I'm going to be spending quite a lot of time throughout these lectures talking about cosimplicial gadgets and the standard reference, well, the time-honored reference is the book of Bousfield and Kahn, and then there's a, in some ways, more palatable version of this in Gauss and Jardine. So nevertheless, everybody has to have the experience at some time in their life of trying to read Bousfield and Kahn. You know, you sort of, it's like falling into a some sort of whirlpool. You know, you just get closer and closer, and things start spinning faster and faster. Eventually, you're meant to get to the proof. You can never quite find out where the proof ended. They don't use QED signs. But anyway, they don't, in some sense, give any proof. But nevertheless, there are a lot of good ideas. And, yeah. Eventually, you sort of get spat into a very calm ocean where you're reading Quillen and trying to work out how what Quillen's writing proves what Bousfield and Kahn are asserting. Okay, anyway. I'm going to now be interested in a very simple case of this, namely cosimplicial cochain complexes. And eventually, I'm going to be thinking about a cosimplicial differential graded Lie algebra or a cosimplicial L-infinity algebra. Here there's a subtlety. I haven't discussed morphisms of L-infinity algebras, and really here I mean just the very naive notion of a morphism of algebras with these operations on them. So morphisms of complexes which take all of these operations over into the same operation. So now, if I have a cosimplicial cone-shaped complex, I can perform a construction which is called TOTE, for total, which kind of wraps everything up together into a single cochain complex. And it's, well, if you've done any category theory, it's just an end. So, Yes, it is an end, yes. Yes. So maybe I should copy what it is. Oh, I see why I'm getting confused. Okay, so I've written it in the following way, which maybe is a bit confusing. So I'm thinking of delta N is a simplicial set. I just hope that you know what simplicial sets are. And these are the normalized cochains. So this is something very naive, in fact. It's just for each geometric face of the n-simplex, we have one generator of a complex in that dimension. So for example, e.g., for n equals 1, then in degrees 0 and 1, it's z plus z and z, where these represent the two faces of the one simplex. And this is the one simplex. And for n equals 2, it's z, z cubed, and z, z cubed, right. These are the vertices, these are the edges of the two simplex, and this is the face, the interior of the two simplex. So I take this. Now this is... So delta N is a representable simplicial set, so all the delta N's together form a cosimplicial simplicial set. And when I take this contravariant functor on them, I get a simplicial cochain complex. And I tensor that with... So I tensor that with Ln. And I take an end, and I call that TOTE of L. So what is this? This is, I take the product of all of these over all n, and then inside it I look at those which agree when I perform face and when I perform actually all morphisms in the category delta. So it's essentially, it's those elements of the product, and goes from 0 to infinity of this, which glue. So it's a bit vague. But for now, what you can certainly imagine is if I look at the faces from delta n to... So delta n minus 1 sits inside delta n in n plus 1 different ways, and so I can restrict these or I can push forward in these, and I have to have agreement. So the restriction to the faces is given by the corresponding morphisms from ln minus 1 into ln. That come from the fact that I have a cosimplicial cochain complex. So that defines tote, and that is a cochain complex with respect to the total differential coming from the differential here and the differential here. And the question is this a differential graded Lie algebra? If I started with a cosimplicial differential graded Lie algebra, or even a, suppose I started with a cosimplicial Lie algebra, is this a differential graded Lie algebra? And the answer is no. There's no reason for it to be, because this is not a graded commutative algebra. In order to obtain some Lie structure, I'm going to need to be able to tensor a Lie algebra to a something, whatever this is, and get a Lie algebra, and that isn't, and I can't. That's not, it's false. The reason is this is not a commutative algebra, as we know. The cochains on a simplicial set have a somewhat more complicated structure, which is sometimes these days called an E-infinity algebra. And I'm going to use a very sort of sharp form of that construction, which in which I am able to put a canonical L-infinity structure on this tensor product. So in my remaining time today, I want to talk a little about the steps I need to do in order to put L-infinity structures on tensor products like this. So let's throw away the tote for now and just look at, and in fact, I'm going to immediately go to a much more abstract setting, bear in mind where I'm headed, that I want to eventually, for example, think of Ln as sections of holomorphic vector fields over some Czech nerve of a complex manifold, and I want to produce an L-infinity algebra. Okay? So this was done, in fact, first by Hinnich and Schechtmann, and what I'm going to show you is a much more effective way of doing it, in the sense of I'm going to give you actual formulas for all of the L-infinity products. So the method, which is increasingly popular these days, so as Mike said, that's now going to, for the next 1,000 years, people will be able to hear my sneeze. So the method is homological perturbation theory. And the basic idea is going to be the following. Suppose I have an L-infinity algebra, and suppose I have the following context. So I have another cochain complex, and I have maps of cochain complexes, I and J. I is an inclusion, and J is a projection. So say that more carefully, the composition of I with J is the identity. Well, the composition in the other direction will then be a projection operation, an idempotent, and I want it to be in a very strong way, homotopic to the identity. So I also need a homotopy. So H has degree -1. And I have that these two endomorphisms of L are homotopic, that is, they equal, the difference between them equals dH plus hd. And then I'm going to assume what are called the side conditions. Well, the first side conditions I'd like are, if I'm already in M, then I want the homotopy to vanish. And the second set of side conditions are that if I take the homotopy and follow it by J, that I get zero. So this is the first collection of side conditions. What did I say? H composed with I equals zero, and J composed with H equals zero. And you can enforce this by replacing H by 1 minus I composed with J, H, 1 minus I composed with J. So if you check, you'll see this new H satisfies these conditions, and it also satisfies this condition. So that's just because the cube of this is equal to itself. The second set of side conditions are we want H composed with H to equal zero. And again, it's easy to arrange that. You can replace this H satisfying one with HDH. Yeah. I think I got that right. Something like that. Okay, if it's not that, then it's something very close to it. So, in practice, the H that I will use will satisfy these side conditions automatically. So I won't need to engage in this maneuver. But it's nice to know, and this was observed by Lam and Stashev, that this is these side conditions are in some sense no additional hypothesis. So now I'm going to state the basic theorem, and next time I'll apply it to construct a wealth of L-infinity algebras and to prove this theorem. So the basic idea is as follows. Now suppose that L is an L-infinity algebra. So I'm going to construct a canonical L-infinity structure on M. So in some sense, we're pushing the L-infinity structure down to this more compact representation of the homotopy type of L in the category of cochain complexes. But the nice thing about this is that the formulas are canonical and, in fact, quite easy to handle, although a little tricky to write down. So I'll just do them in some schematic way. So actually I should mention that all of this becomes easier if you use the brace version of the operations, not the up there and not the bracket ones, if you shift all the degrees, because that eliminates a lot of the confusing signs. So I have elements of M x1 up to xn. And the first thing I'm going to do is apply I to each of them. So I now have n elements of L. And let me say, the last thing I'm going to do is apply J. But everything in between is going to be a calculation inside L. Now, it's a perturbative calculation, and it's quite delightful then that just like in physics, we're going to sum over Feynman graphs. So it really is perturbation theory. And the Feynman graphs, they're actually trees. So we sum over all rooted trees with leaves labeled 1 up to n. There's just a finite number of them, fortunately, so this will be a finite sum. So, for example, for n equals 3, oh, I've got this weird habit of drawing trees with the root in the air. Maybe I should try to... It's been referred to as Down Under syndrome. So, for example, for n equals 3, I have 4 trees. Notice, I really mean trees here, not planar trees. I'm not paying any attention to the order in which the branches emerge from each vertex. And then in here, I put an expression which is formed as follows. For each vertex, I take a bracket in L, and for each edge, I take H. So for a physicist, we think of H as the inverse of the propagator, somehow. And the interactions are just the higher brackets. So incidentally, from the point of view of Mike's second lecture, there's a version of all of this where you have inner products kicking around. And then this procedure takes if everything here is compatible with inner products, then it takes something which is compatible with inner products here and produces something down here. So here we put an expression with a bracket for each vertex with k branches and H for each edge. By edge, I just mean interior edges. I don't mean these ones on the outside. So here there are 0 edges, and here there's 1 edge. And what's remarkable is that the degrees work out. Everything works out very neatly. For example, here, the triple bracket in L has degree -1, which agrees with the degree of the triple bracket in M. Here we get 2 double brackets which contribute degree 0 to the total, and a copy of H which reduces the degree by 1. So it's homogeneous. And so, for example, so X bracket Y in M is just J of IX, IM, IY in L, which is the most natural definition. We perform the bracket up in L, and then just project the answer back down into M. But this is no longer, in general, a Lie bracket. And the next bracket corrects that, and I'll finish with this point. And now we have signs, and I don't know the signs, so let's pretend that even though I said we're in characteristic 0, we're also in characteristic 2. I left out I's here. And so it's, well, something like J of H of IX, IY, bracket IZ, all of these brackets are in L, plus 2 more terms. And you can kind of, I hope, begin to see what's going on. If L, for example, had just been an ordinary differential graded Lie algebra, it wouldn't have had any non-zero triple brackets. So this piece wouldn't be here, and we'd just have some expression constructed from the homotopy and from the bracket of L. And the idea is this thing has terms which exactly correspond to the Jacobi relation, and when you start taking the differential of this, you find exactly that it's a homotopy for the Jacobi relation. So that you've artfully worked out how to use this in a nonlinear setting. So why does all this work? Actually, at some level, you can think of this as a naive homological perturbation theory applied to the Chevalier-Eilenberg cochains of L and M. This is not necessarily my favorite way of thinking about it, but because I've never seen anybody write out the proof in that context. The naive way to approach this is just to write out the proof. And I've seen this theorem stated in lectures of Fourcrier from about 2001. At some way, this theorem has been resonating in mathematics since the 70s. So I hesitate, but it wasn't clearly stated, I think, until Fourcrier in 2001. That this is an L infinity algebra. Yeah, yeah. So what I'm going to do next time is we'll see that we can replace the simplicial cochains of the n-simplex by differential forms on the n-simplex. This, of course, for anybody who's read Sullivan, is a very natural thing to do. Differential forms are a commutative algebra, graded commutative algebra. So we're now in really good shape. We have a differential graded Lie algebra, or at least L infinity algebra. The problem is it's not the original question. But now there's exactly a homotopy from differential forms on the n-simplex down to cochains on the n-simplex. And this is essentially the Durand theorem. So I'm going to explain that next time, how DuPont gave an explicit formula for a homotopy. It's a homotopy which then only works in characteristic zero. And for me, that's where characteristic zero will actually be important. But this, of course, is not surprising, because differential forms only calculate the cohomology of the simplex in characteristic zero. Otherwise, you have the famous problem of Cartier operations and so on. So that's the structure of the setup. We have this general construction, and then we apply it to a very particular context in order to get all the L infinity algebras that I want. And then next time I'll show you how this can be used to recover the Lie group of a Lie algebra, to recover this Deligne groupoid of a differential graded Lie algebra, and also to get other constructions, including many examples of Lie n-groups. So, and then in the final lecture, I'll talk about descent for n-groupoids and compare the two constructions. Okay, thank you. I guess this being lectures, anybody who wanted to ask a question has already asked one. Okay.